Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to the Whitetail Podcast. This is the Sedin Special Edition as we get ready to crank stuff out. I know you guys are all busy during Sedin Week, joined by Ben Kuzma and Ed Willis. Thanks to our sponsor, Key West Ford, keywestford.com, BC's largest selection of Mustangs. If you're interested in that, check out their website. Ed, let's start with you. We're going to see a week now where they've, you know, give marketing credit. They've done a great job on this 50th anniversary. One of the things we're doing is one of the top 50 moments that I know you're writing about is literally how they got the Sedins. And I know I've talked to Ben about this as well. I just, in today's NHL, I cannot fathom being able to engineer to get the second and third pick overall. It starts and begins there with Brian Burke, does it not?
Well, today's NHL, forget that. The history of the NHL, I'm pretty sure, and I've got to go back over this. I don't think a team has ever had two of the top three picks in the draft. So that's one. And it is a great cloak and dagger story of how Burke pulls this off, because it starts with them getting the trade with Chicago, which was done weeks before the draft. So he goes in there with the fourth pick overall in his pocket. And where were the Canucks? Were they sitting second or third at that point? It gets really confusing. And then everything that happens that. So that's just kind of the one level. For me, the other thing that jumps out at me is, what if the Canucks don't make that trade? What if they come out of the draft with Pavel Brendl? And it was kind of up in the air right up until Rick Dudley walks over and says, yeah, we have a deal for the Canucks to move up and to get these two picks, to get the first overall pick, I'm sorry. You look at all the trades that were made in and around there, all the players that were involved, the Tampa Rangers trade, which kind of fell on the end of that. All the players involved don't add up to one good Sedin season between them. It's just astonishing to me that there was so few impact players, players who even had a decent NHL career, come out of all those moves, and the Canucks come out of it for maybe the first time in franchise history with these two Hall of Famers, two franchise icons, a Hart Trophy winner, an Art Ross Trophy winners, and the two players that carried this team from the NHL lockout in the first season out of the lockout in 05-06 to the moment they retired. It really is an amazing story, and you kind of get inured to it because we watched them for so long. But when you come back on it with a fresh set of eyes and look and really consider what happened, boy, it's a remarkable tale.
Ben, on that point, we've all had our battles with Brian Burke, and I certainly have during the days when he was working here for the Canucks, but you really have to admire a GM who literally has the balls to go out and get it moves like that done. As Ed said, like, not only has it never happened before, if he hadn't pulled it off, like, he really swung for the fences.
Yeah, and we've documented it, and I'm sure it'll resurface again as we get closer to Wednesday. I mean, what he did as a Harvard-trained bully lawyer, probably in today's world there'd be maybe a restraining order against him, or maybe some charges of assault or whatever. The cloak and dagger, the actual bullying that he had to do to pull it off, I don't think that can be replicated in today's NHL. And but again, to your point earlier, I remember a 7 or 8 week period where Brian didn't talk to me, and it's almost a badge of honor as a beat writer where you wrote something that the general manager didn't like, and he would usually put a finger in your chest and let you know how much he didn't like. And I'll just tell a quick story about the other side of Brian Burke is that fact that when he did leave here and go to Anaheim, and I think we were trying to surmise how his hockey ops department would be put together, I remember calling Brian up after we decided to sort of mend the fences and said, what about this guy, Brian? I think he would work really well in that respect for you. And he said to me, if you write that in the paper tomorrow, you're going to look pretty smart. And I think we've all had those kind of interactions with Brian. You know, there's another side to him, but boy, when he had the laser focus on what he was going to do that draft weekend, because, you know, the way things have worked out for the past with the Canucks, Ed, and, you know, Patrick Stefan could have dropped and they would have ended up with him instead of the Twins. A lot of different scenarios could have come out, but that's amazing. And when you go back and you look at it blow by blow, it's absolutely blows your mind because that would not happen today.
One of the great ponderables as you kick scenarios around is if the Sedins don't end up on the same team. Because I think if you're a newer Canuck fan, or maybe you just weren't paying attention to the start of their career, they were whipping boys for the fans. They did not come out of the gate strong. In fact, you can look at a guy like Jake Virtanen, and there were a lot of players or fans 3, 4, 5 years in who were saying, enough, these guys are never going to make it. And I really wonder what their futures had been had they been on two different teams.
I'm sorry, Ed. I asked the Sedins that question before they went into the BC Sports Hall of Fame last May. And I said, what if you didn't end up on the same team? And I can't remember, I think it was Henrik told me that if one of us was drafted, the other one would opt out of the draft, hoping that the team would pick them up the following year. Because they did not want to be separate. They wanted to play together. And I never heard that before.
Interesting. I can only tell you, Burke, in the course of a really interesting 20-minute phone call, said he went up to them before the draft and he said, if it doesn't happen today, stay patient. I'm going to get both of you on the same team. I don't know if it back to the early years. I don't know if it's revisionist history, but the couple of people I've talked to who are intimately involved with them include like Mike Johnson, the assistant coach, Marcus Naslund, Burke, Trevor Linden. They say no. We saw it. We just knew it would take time. And okay, that's funny because you were members of a very small club. But having said that, these are, you know, pretty educated hockey men with a keen eye for talent. And they talk about a couple of things that were apparent even when they weren't setting the world on fire. First of all, being the hockey sense just jumped out at you. But Burke said, even though they weren't producing at a great clip, they noticed a couple of things. Once that cycle game just wore out the second pair defense on the other team. Wore out the Sedins too, for that matter. But he said, you know, he would tie them out, and they would be able to get stuff off that second defense appearing later in the game. The other thing is, it gave him a pretty good second power play unit. And even if they weren't always producing, they were creating stuff. They weren't losing momentum, and it was kind of their training ground. So just putting that out there, that's kind of what they saw. And like I said, Marcus, Trevor, all these people said, oh yeah, we could see it. We just knew it would take time.
Yeah, we tend to forget that in his rookie year, Daniel had 20 goals.
Yeah.
And as much as they struggled those first few years, I talked to Ed Jovanovski about trying to defend them even in practice. And you know how Jovo was?
Yep.
You know, he'd get a little pissed. And he said it was unbelievable. He said, you turn your back on them, it's one thing. But when you face them face to face, you're mesmerized by them, even in practice, when they had to try to shut them down. So imagine in a game scenario. So generational players.
I do remember hearing them talk, I think after, or maybe it was around the 2011 season, where they did reference the fact that when they were drafted, for all this talk and belief and faith and machination that went into getting them, at that they were obviously prized assets, that they honestly thought that they would play 3-4 seasons in the NHL and then go back to Sweden. And again, I don't know if that's just them being humble or if that's a reality that they were just sort of so unassuming, like, well, yeah, let's go try this out because we're hockey players, but then, you know, we'll go home. Did it surprise you guys that they became so entrenched in Vancouver that, you know, this is where their lives are now?
I think it's a Swedish thing to, you know, when you talk to some of the Swedish players, that there's something, I don't know whether it's the water, something in Vancouver, because remember when Marcus was traded here and he struggled initially, and there's some thought, and he just kind of embraced the city. And, you know, one of the things we're looking at during Sedin's week, there's been 27 Swedes play for the Canucks over the 50 years, including Oscar Fantenberg, by the way. And whether it's the ability to skate at an NHL level when they come over and the ability to process the game and think it. Most of the players I've talked to about the Sedins, they all reference the same thing. Whether they were having a good day or a bad day or in a scoring slump, you never know. The way they approach the game, the way they approach their lives, everything on the upbeat, an underlying drive and will to succeed and never wearing it on their sleeves. As something's really bugging me, I'm in a horrendous slump, things aren't happening. And to show that, they never showed it. And I think that's a Swedish thing.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in storylines and storytelling and in mythology and all those things. And one of the things as we worked through, and it actually came up when I was doing a piece on Marcus Naslund, Sweden, yes, but specifically Modo. Yeah. And the current that runs through Canucks history, because it's not only Thomas Gradin, who's really at you know the apex of the pyramid here. But I asked Marcus about that, and he goes, yeah, Thomas Gradin, I wasn't really aware of Vancouver, but I was aware of the connection with Modo. And then he rattles off Thomas Gradin, but then there's Lars Lindgren and Lars Molin. Forgot about that completely. So he said, yeah, so we were all aware of them in Ørnskjoldsvik when we, and am I pronouncing that right? I've been
Sveik,
trying to take,
yeah,
I've
say been trying, that's
been
what all the kids are saying.
20 years Sveik. And I'm still not sure with yeah. it. And I end up with this like really, 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 really awkward pronunciation. Anyways, so Marcus's knowledge and connection with the Vancouver market goes back through that. Now the Twins come from the same town, and who do they turn to? Who's already here? Well, it's Marcus, and Matthias Olin, I understand, is from another part, as Berkey said. He's from up there in reindeer country. But they have this, so they have this support system of players deeply respected in their hometown, in their country, who were pretty good NHL players when they arrived, too. So they're set up that way. And Berg did mention one thing about that support system they had that Olin didn't have when he arrived in Vancouver, when Naslund didn't have when he arrived in Pittsburgh. And I think that helped them. And, you know, they've referenced that. So, you know, I think they were going to get there eventually. But I think having that support system gave them a comfort level.
Then the evolution of them as these, you know, shy kids who came in, and it's funny you talked about, you know, tiring out the second unit, but tiring themselves out. I think they became legendary for the stamina that they built up. We all saw the pictures that Canucks would give us of them running the grouse grind and everything else. They became the consummate professionals, and then they became mentors. I mean, certainly for a guy like Alexander Edler as well, who's still here. And again, Ed, I can still remember columns that you wrote when it was like, we've seen flashes of Edler as this young player. If he could only do this on a regular basis, he could be a Norris Trophy winning defenseman. Now, we can argue whether or not he delivered on enough of that promise, but they played that role of mentor, not just players like him, but other players now that we've seen.
Yeah, that, you know, and Ben, I believe, is writing about it, and it really is an interesting and kind of underreported aspect of Canucks history is this Swedish connection that runs back, like I said, all the way through Gradin. But has there been a period in their history where they didn't have a significant contributor from Sweden in the lineup? There might be a year or two somewhere in the, you know, when Gradin started to lose it in the 80s. But yeah, no, it's a big part of the story and will continue to be a big story.
Yeah, I was going through that last night, and it seemed to be from decade to decade. And an interesting thing, too, when you fast forward this thing, and I was talking to Elias Pettersson about this last year, just transforming to North American society, assimilating to a different league, different type of game, different size rink. And to have Swedes in the room, you mentioned Edler and Eriksson, and man, he went on how he not only knew about them as a fellow Swede, but how they made the transition so much easier for him. You know, whether it's things like opening up a bank account or trying to find a place to live. That's often lost on people. Don't understand that as a professional athlete. It's one thing if you're from North America, but if you're from another part of the world, and I think that that's helped the transition. And, you know, I talked to Cliff Running about this the other day about the Swedes, and he said, you know, the one thing about them, you know, the one thing I always remember about, you know, whether it was Thomas Gradin or whoever, they would always take time with you. They would really formulate a good answer. They just wouldn't blurt something out. And I said to Cliff, do you know who you just described? And he said, who? Elias Pettersson. And isn't it amazing, a kid that young, right off the bat last year. And maybe again, that's a Swedish thing. I don't know. But to formulate an answer as such a young kid and give you something and not just a cliche was really quite remarkable.
Do you guys have a moment either on or off the ice in all your years covering them that really stands out to you? Because you both covered their whole careers.
Well, it's crazy. We were talking about that before we came in. And for me, I'm sorry, it will always be walking into that dressing room after Game 7 of the 2011 Stanley Cup Final, and it is bereft of Canucks, and the Twins are standing there in front of their stalls like they always did. They're accountable. They're answering all the questions, and they're basically speaking for the whole team, if not the whole city and the whole province at this point. And again, that just said so much about them to me. And it was just such an arresting image to walk in there in this like supreme moment of defeat and what it revealed about their character. And quite frankly, what it revealed about the characters of a lot of the other players on that team.
I think the final home game at Rogers Arena that they played, and you know, game day skates, are they're out there for 10 or 15 minutes and there's a little bit of back and forth with everybody and it's time to play the game. They stood there. There were a few of us, the guys that basically covered them forever, and we talked for 20 going on 30 minutes on game day about the game, about life, about stuff happening in their personal lives, away from the rink. I save that because it's the kind of thing when you're, you know, I'm going to go back and listen to this again because it was a kind of a life lesson. These two superlative players who are about to play their final home game on home ice wanted to talk about the city, wanted to talk about their kids, wanted to talk about things they're going to be able to do, like skiing or whatever. That one always resonates with me. And the other one is running into Henrik Sedin at Whole Foods, and we're discussing what kind of apples we like the best. We're having a big discussion about apples. I like the Granny Smith. He likes the Macintosh. We're going back and forth.
Such a cliched Vancouver story.
But he was so human. It was just what do you think about this apple?
I've got one of those. It's funny. Like for all the interactions it had over the year, I never got the feeling I knew them. But I knew them. Like, because I think who they were as players, the way they conducted them, that's who they were.
Because they treated everybody the same, and not like you needed a secret decoder ring.
No, 100%. And you kind of kept looking, you know, for kind of a way in, and maybe to pull back the curtain and reveal something, you know, something a little else. I just don't think it was there. So my story is, I'm meeting my wife for lunch, and we're somewhere on the west side, and we sit down, and this kind of, you know, you kind of feel a presence sitting beside you, turn, and it's Daniel. And he's meeting his wife for lunch, and it's a little awkward. You don't know whether to engage and all the rest of it. And my wife, God bless her, doesn't really follow the hockey real closely. So we kind of end up, we start chatting, and I introduce him, and I say, you know, my wife's a high-level educator. She's a principal at a girls' private school. And they start talking, and they start talking about kids, about education, about where Daniel's kids are. And it's actually fascinating listening to this, because clearly this is such a huge priority in his life. And so they end up, you know, we pay the bill and we end up and we're walking out of there. And again, Kathy looks and she goes, I'm pretty sure she knew it was a Sedin. I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt there. But she certainly didn't know which one and she wasn't picking up on the clues. But it was kind of a cool, unguarded moment that again revealed about where the priorities were and, you know, just and you know, their place in this community.
So while Daniel and your wife were chatting about education, you didn't strike up?
Not so much.
You're the third conversation
with Daniel's wife talking about
favorite recipes? No, not so much. I know one of the kids was really into horses, as you'd expect. I think they played soccer, and yeah, it's kind of lost in the mist of time.
Yeah, it says a lot. Like right now, since they've been retired, I know Patrick Johnson, who's on the road with the team right now, had tried to talk to Daniel in particular about his running marathons, or I know they coach soccer, and they've refused to talk about it. They do not. They're like, no one cares about this. We're not the story anymore, and that says so much.
No,
about
I told PJ he's not going to talk to you. You're just a grasshopper on the beat.
Where do they rank for you guys in terms of greatest Canucks?
Oh, 1-1A. There's no doubt in my mind. Yeah, and probably
who's one.
I think Henrik, just because he had the one transcendent season. And I know Daniel's 2011-2012 what was great, but Art Ross, Hart, he was the captain for a reason. You know, and we're talking about such a fine line between the two of them. But
probably a purple heart for Henrik having to stand in front of us night after night after all those seasons that weren't very good.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something to be said for that because eventually, I mean, Marcus sometimes used to wear it on his face.
Mm-hmm.
He knew it was a tough go some nights, but Henrik handled it with tremendous aplomb.
It is interesting though because had Daniel not had the injury that one year, that one season they might have been closer, right, in terms of their numbers.
Still pisses me off to this day that Duncan Keith, it was like such a cowardly check. And you know, for him to get suspended 5 games at the tail end of a regular season that meant absolutely nothing. I'm still not sure. Daniel will argue differently, and he had productive seasons after that. I'm not sure if he was ever the same player after that, Jack.
Most players will tell you that, you know, whether it's a back injury or whatever, I'm X amount of percent, and they'll never give you the percentage.
Yeah.
I did want to get into maybe other Canuck greats and who should be next to go in, but I think that would take too long, and we've gone long enough here, and I want to save something for that can be a topic for next week. We'll talk about
that. One-word answers.
Yeah.
And then we can get into later, yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Well, tease. I believe that's called a tease,
well,
isn't it,
in this business? One of the reasons is I know
I'm considering a change in careers, by the way. That's one.
I know that Ben has had a conversation with Ryan Kesler, and I think you can make an argument with the Canucks, as we've examined the glorious stories in their history. They've only won a handful of trophies, and Kessler is one of them who's won a major player trophy. And I think in other organizations, you could maybe make that argument. But I mean, is there any? We'll go into this in detail next week. But Ben, is there anyone for you who I think is next on deck?
Well, there's a trio there. There's Ryan Kesler, who you mentioned, won a Selke trophy, probably should have won at least more than one. I think he was the best defensive center in the game for years, not to take anything away from Patrice Bergeron or Jonathan Toews. Won a series single-handedly, 41 goals. You've got Ryan Kesler, you've got Roberto Luongo, and you've got Todd Bertuzzi. And you know how this marketplace is. Maybe not so much the marketplace. I guess it's the franchise, because it's not what you did. It's how you left. Ryan Kesler wanted out. I had a very engaging, long conversation with him about that the other night. We know what happened, Roberto's contract and leaving and trying to find a place to play. And Bertuzzi's, you know, the Steve Moore stuff, whatever. It's really fascinating to me that how this organization is going to go forward from here and recognize people who need to be, who are deserving of something. And I'm focusing in on Ryan Kesler on a piece. And I think at least the Ring of Honor. And you could probably go higher than that. But boy, in this marketplace, it's going to be so polarizing, because for 6 people who admired everything he did, 6 people had a problem with him. So it's going to be a pretty interesting piece.
Yeah, for me, it's Luongo. You've got to prioritize. You've got to make a judgment. And Luongo was just such a transcendent figure, like from the moment he arrived here. And he was right in the middle of it. And to me, there's no question Luongo was the next guy. And yeah.
We'll talk about it more next week.
Absolutely.
But one of the things with Luongo, it's so interesting you say that, Ed. I remember that he was almost like what Reggie White was to Green Bay in the NFL, where, you know, that was a small market where they were like, big players won't go there. And there was such insecurity in Vancouver that Luongo was going to leave as soon as his contract was done. Because Pavel had left and people didn't want to come and play here. And everyone was going to the Rangers. And to have a superstar say, no, I like it here, I want to be part of something, was really unique. So
yeah, and that first season of his ranks with the greatest individual Canucks seasons of all time. It's just a notch below Henrik's season, in my opinion. You know, Hart Trophy finalist, Vezina finalist, he was that team that year.
And I think with him, there's this fascinating story that once that Twitter account became known, there was a completely different side of his personality that we all knew.
So. And it's a funny thing, too, again, at the end of it all, I mean, when he decided to retire as opposed to go to camp and say, I'm not medically fit to perform, the Canucks will tell you, wow, that cap recapture penalty is really sticking in our craw. Because that's how they think. And that gets back to my point about how did people leave?
Don't critique a win, Ben. Don't critique a win. All right, gents, thank you very much. Thank you, Darm, for your patience sitting through these podcasts here today. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Key West Ford, keywestford.com, BC's largest selection of trucks, and also Mustangs if you want them. We'll be back next week, folks, with all the Sedin's Week, jersey retirements, insights, Linden, Naslin, Bure, the whole bit. So thanks for listening, and talk to you later.